Hi, people. Welcome back to Dr. Sam's Musings. how's the month going and how's the week going so far? I hope you're having an amazing week. As announced on my Instagram page, I will be having a Q&A session for the last two episodes of the podcast this year. So this Wednesday and next Wednesday, I'll be answering questions that people have sent in via my Instagram DM. And I think I have about 15 questions in total. So I'll get started and we'll see how far we can go this week. If not, we'll continue again next week. And I absolutely love the mix of the questions. It's a random mishmash of just parenting, marriage, business, religion. Yeah, so it's just the perfect mix for the podcast. So let's get straight into it. So the first question says, how does one practically become more self-aware? People say, be yourself. How do you discover who you really are in this world? And how does one become more self-reflective? Okay, so I feel like in recent times, I haven't spoken as much about this topic as I used to, but it was something that I used to talk about all the time because this is something that greatly, greatly, greatly helped me in my life. Like being self-aware and having a healthy dose of self-love is something that makes me able to honestly go for most of the things that I want to do without really caring about what other people think and whatnot. And for me, it's a four-step process. The first process is a thorough self-analysis. The second is self-awareness. The third is self-development. And then the fourth is self-love. So self-analysis is actually a process. It's something that I started many years ago. And it's something that is actually like an exercise that you have to do over a period of time to really, really get to know yourself. And I always advise, and this is something that I teach in my classes. I even had a course on it, but I think it's gone off. I think the website I was hosting it on has gone off now. I always advise people, take a sheet of paper and literally draw two columns. On that each column, So take a sheet of paper and draw two columns, your pros and your cons column. Under each column, what you're going to do is you're going to pick the things in your life that matter to you. So I always do my self-analysis on topics like spirituality, family or relationships, health and wellness, finances, and then there's always a column for just Samia. So those are the topics that matter to me. Those are the things that matter to me. So spirituality, so Dean and spirituality, health and wellness, family and relationships, wealth and finances and wealth, basically, and just Samia. And under each of those columns, you're going to do your pros and your cons. And you have to, the thing about self-analysis is itself. So you have to be honest with yourself. The first time might be quite emotionally raw for you because it's something that you have to dig deep. There are many people that if you ask them about themselves, what is your strength in your marriage? They cannot answer because they've never thought about it. So it's not tip of the tongue as it is for some of us that have answered these questions for years by ourselves. So you might have to dig deep and sometimes you might not like the answers that you come up with. You may realize, to be honest, I don't think I have anything that I can consider a strength. You might need to ask other people. You might need to, you know, just to get you going. But it's a very, very, you know, emotionally, you know, stirring process. So you do your pros and cons under each of those, you know, categories. So let's say, for example, spirituality and Dean or Dean and spirituality, you can say, oh, I say my prayers on time 5 times a day, day in, day out, I say my prayers on time, you know, 5 times a day. And under cons, you can write things like, I don't do my nafl. I wish I did more nafl, or I wish I had more kushu in my prayers. I mean, they don't have to match. I'm just saying that I'm just giving examples. You know, you just write down the things that you consider your pros and cons, and there's no limit to how many you can do. So you can use a whole notebook. You can use a single sheet, whatever it is that you want. Just write down as many pros and cons. You can limit yourself to 5. You can do as many as you want, really. Just write down as many pros and cons as you want. Then you move on to your health and wellness. You can write for health and wellness. Okay, I think I eat pretty healthy most of the time. Under cons, you can write, I wish I moved more. I wish I did more of a workout. Pros, you can write, oh, I like how my body looks. Cons, you can write, oh, I wish, you know, just write down the things that you feel are your strengths and the things that you feel are your weaknesses under each of those columns, and you go on until you finish. So what this does is it gives you like a very, very significant look at yourself through your own lens. And the thing is, because you don't have to share with anybody, because nobody else has to see it, you can afford to be as brutally honest with yourself or as, you know, as self-praising as you want. But the thing is, you have to be honest. You have to be able to tell yourself the truth. And what this does is it gives you like a thorough analysis of yourself. You look on the sheet, at the sheet of paper and you're like, wow. On the pro side, you're like, oh my God, I'm actually not a bad person at all. I'm actually a cool person. Look at all these things that I do. Look at all these things that I am. On the con side, you see things that you're like, ish, you know, I wish I was better and that. And then on the con side, so here's where the practical part comes in. On the con side, you're going to split your list into the things that you can actually change and the things that you cannot do anything about. And you just have to try and live it. So for example, one of my cons might be something like, I'm short, you know, something like that. There's nothing you can do about being short at 40. I'm not short, though. I'm just saying, you know, there's nothing you can do about being short at, say, 41 years old, unless you want to go for leg lengthening surgery, which is a crazy idea. There's nothing you can do. So you have to kind of live with that. Or you can have a mental con, say, you know, you had a traumatic experience in the past. You can reach into your past and change people that have been in your past. You have to learn to deal, you know, with that con. The people that have said things like, oh, I wish I was, my con is I wasn't raised in a loving family. You can't change that. You can't go to the past and change the fact that your family wasn't loving. But if you have the effect of that in your life, say maybe you find it difficult to express love, you can decide to change that. So on the list of the things that you can change, you're going to itemize, you're going to pick them. And another thing that you shouldn't do is overwhelm yourself, because if you find that there are a lot of things about yourself that you want to change, you don't try and change everything at the same time. You walk through things, you give yourself time, you pace yourself. So you can say, oh, you know, under my health and wellness cons, I wrote that I want to work out more. So you don't just say, you don't just write, I'm going to start working out tomorrow. No, you're going to give yourself action steps. You're going to really, really itemize, okay, this is what I want to achieve. I want to lose 5 kg over the next year. That means I have to lose so and so kg by so and so time. That means I have to work out for so and so minutes. You are really, literally going to break it down into actionable points for yourself, and then you're going to start implementing the smallest bite size possible implementable action point is what you want, because the brain gets overwhelmed by big changes. But when you introduce changes a little bit, you can kind of trick the brain into accepting it. So the smallest bite-sized actionable points are what you're going to write down. And if you begin to implement these things bit by bit consistently, you will begin to see the changes that you desire. There's nothing that beats consistency. Absolutely nothing. Everything you want to achieve, you can achieve from consistency. So you don't have to do anything crazy or anything over the top. It's just doing little things every day towards the life that you truly desire. And the more effort you put in into changing yourself and changing your life and, you know, being a better version of yourself, the more you begin to, you know, also when you do the self-analysis, you become self-aware. You know who you are. Like, okay, this is who I am. So you take away the power of people being able to. So for example, someone says you're short, you can say, well, I know. I mean, what's the big deal? You kind of know. So you take that power back. You know, some people are so worried about people using their negatives to mock them or whatnot. But when you take the power back from that, then nobody can mock you with it anymore. So you know yourself, you're self-aware, and then you use the information from that self-awareness to begin to develop yourself. And the more effort you put into developing yourself, when you begin to see those changes, you begin to love yourself, you accept the things that you cannot change, and you change the things that you can, and you begin to evolve into this beautiful butterfly, and you begin to just love on yourself more and more, because we appreciate the efforts that we put into things. When you do things, when you work at something, just like when you have a plant and you nurture it and you water it every day, you just have some sort of love for that plant. The same thing with our children. When you put in effort and you see, you know, even just little things like when you dress your child nice and the child comes out, you are just filled with one kind of pride, like, ah, see my cutie. It's the same thing for yourself. The more effort you put into your life to become a better version of yourself, the more you love on yourself. So that's it. Those are the four steps that I've implemented. And the thing that it does for you, again, is that it gives you a very quantitative way of assessing yourself over time. So for example, if you do a self-analysis once every year or once every quarter, whatever time works for you, if you compare what you did last time and what you did this time, and you notice that before you wrote that you wanted to lose 10 kg, now it's down to 5 kg, it gives you like a really, really you know, quantitative way of assessing yourself as against a vague one. You can be like, oh my God, I've actually made 5 kg progress. I'm so proud of myself and things like that. Or you can say, oh, there was a part where you said, oh, you wanted to read more Quran daily. And this time around you're writing, oh, you know, it has suddenly moved from a con to a pro where you're writing that, oh, I read my Quran daily. So it gives you a way to assess your self-growth and development. I don't want to spend too much time on this because, like I said, I have a course on it, so I could go on and on. But yeah, that's how you practically assess yourself. That's how you practically know yourself, become aware of yourself, and then you become determined to develop yourself. And then you get to love on yourself. So I have another question that feeds into this one. And that one says, you're so confidently and unapologetically you. How do you get to a point where you don't care what people think or say? Funny enough, I get this question a lot. And I dare say that it would be a big fat lie to say that there's any human being that completely 100% doesn't care what other people think or say. I think that for me, it's just a case of sometimes I do care. Sometimes people's words do get to me, but I just never internalize anything that people say. Praise or insults or criticisms. I take what I need from it and I move right along. And it comes from having a healthy, you know, sense of self-awareness and just knowing myself really well. So there's certain things that you can say to me. Like if you say, Samia, you're a liar, or Samia, you're a gossip, immediately I'm going to tell you, no, I'm not. You know, maybe there was a situation that maybe made you perceive of me that way or whatnot, but I can confidently tell you that I don't lie and I don't gossip. At least not to an extent that anybody could ever call me a liar or a gossip. Do you understand? The things I know about myself that I can beat my chest and say, this is who I am, you know, and even the things that I'm still working on. Like if you tell me certain things about myself, I can be like, yes, I know. Like if you say, oh, you're talkative, I know. You're this, I know. And if I feel like there's a problem, I'm most likely working on it already. So you cannot tell me something about myself that I don't already know. And because I know myself and I don't do things carelessly, I don't make decisions carelessly. I'm very prayerful. I am very analytical. Even though I have a very healthy, spontaneous bone in my body as well, but I, especially things for public consumption, like classes or things I write on social media, they come to me, I stop and think about them. I hardly do those things spontaneously. Anything that has to go out in the public that people can criticize or people can have an opinion about, I hardly do them spontaneously. So before anybody can come at me with anything, I already have that armor of, I'm sure of myself. I know why I'm doing this. And yeah, sometimes some people's words will trickle through. You know, some people will say things that will get to you. But like I said, they don't just stay too long in my head. And the truth is, you said I'm confidently and unapologetically me. I really, really, really like who I am. And I say that with the utmost humility. I really, really love who God made me, mind, body, and spirit. I love Samia so much, not because she's perfect, but because she's constant work in progress. And I know how far I've come from who I was 10 years ago. I love how God constantly uses me to mold myself, how he teaches me all these self-development tips and tricks, how I see my flaws, how I see my strengths, and I really, really love who I am. So it will take a really, really powerful person. I don't think there's any human being. It will take a really powerful person to make me think badly of myself. And I think that's where the confidence thing comes from. I really like who I am. I know who I am. I have worked so hard and I'm constantly working hard at who I am. And it's always with the help of Allah. It's always, you know, me going back to Allah when I fall, when I'm weak, when I have doubts. So it's from a source that no human being could ever interfere with or could ever influence. So I'm really confident. I'm really self-aware. And I really, really, yes, do love who I am. So there's hardly anything that anybody can say that will stay with me for too long. Like it would hurt, it would pinch, my heart might race. But by the next day, I'm typically like, I beg. The next question is, Assalamu alaikum. Please, can you talk about how to mind your business generally and from the Islamic perspective? I mean, it's really self-explanatory. Mind your business. We all have our own businesses. Like you have, this one really, really irks me because everybody has things in their lives that they should be minding. You have your family, you have your business, like your business that pays you money, or your career, you have your health, you have your spirituality, your own relationship with God, you have your staff, you have your home that you're managing, you have your unique trials, you have so many things in your life that you should pay attention to. But a lot of people will leave all those things, even when they need their attention, and go and put their noses in other people's lives. This is completely counterproductive. It is a sin in Islam. Being nosy is, you're not supposed to be suspicious. You're not supposed to be nosy. You're not supposed to stick your nose in other people's affairs in Islam. And it's even said, it's a hadith, part of your faith is living that which does not concern you. Like, focus on the things that matter to you. Focus on the things that you, that matter directly to you. So if you sit with me, for example, and we're having a conversation, I will talk about my family, I'll talk about my business, I will talk about my children. I find it very uncomfortable to talk about other people, except that it relates to me in one way or the other. Maybe something happened in my life that involves another person. And even when I'm telling that story, if I have to, it will be from my perspective. I won't embellish, I won't insult, I won't, do you understand? But a lot of people take so much joy and so much delight in sitting down and analyzing other people's lives and talking about other people's lives, forgetting that they have lives too, forgetting that they have things that people can talk about too. And I find that misery loves company. So people that typically have unhappy lives like to project that unhappiness upon others. I mean, people would say it's not true, but it's the truth. So if you are in an unhappy marriage, if you see a happy couple, you're more likely to be like, they're just pretending, they're just this, they're just that. And you push that narrative to the point that it doesn't just stay as being your opinion. You feel the need to buttress that opinion with facts. So this is where people begin to lie. You say things like, oh, I heard that her husband is even this, or I heard that she's even that. And then the next person says it as, oh, no, you start with opinion. It could be that the husband is even this. And then the next person that is passing on that information along will pass it along as fact. And that's how it begins to build. You're poking your nose in someone else's business can start unhealthy rumors that can be very damaging, and there's just no need for it. And this is where gossip and backbiting come in. And in Islam, these are really, really huge sins. On the day of judgment, it's said in Islam that you will eat the flesh of people that you have backbitten. So why do we want to get into that? Like, there's so much in your life that needs conversation. Are you sitting out people asking them, how can I worship Allah better? Are you sitting out asking for health tips or business tips or parenting tips? Are you sitting out reading self-help books or even, you know, just fiction books to make you better as a human being? No, you haven't finished doing that, but you want to go and mind another person's business. This is where I have a problem. If you're talking about things, let it be in a way that, you know, has some positive effect upon your life. You don't sit down and just casually analyze someone's life and draw your own conclusion. It's not your business. It's not your place to. And it's a sin. So let's be very careful about falling into this. The next question is, this one is actually a few questions in one. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How do you move past finding out your significant other had an affair with a random person over a trip? Oh my. Phew, that is a heavy question. So infidelity is never an easy thing to handle. Like, I've spoken to so many people that have dealt with infidelity, and it's not an easy pill to swallow by any stretch of the imagination. But what I always say is this, I don't believe in immediate cancellation. I don't believe in that. If he cheats on you once, leave him. There's certain things that I feel are complete deal breakers. Domestic violence, emotional violence, those ones I feel like, yeah, one time is more than enough. But when it comes to things like infidelity, and for some people it's a solid deal breaker, and I get it because it's such a huge breach of trust. But for me, I always say, if this person has been a good person to you up until this point, if this person has not shown any sign or any whatever of being this person up until this point, then hear them out. But they have to talk about it. Why do you think you fell into this? What happened? What went wrong? And if you feel like it's something that is a one-off, maybe it was in a vulnerable state, maybe this, maybe that, then I feel like you can forgive. Because I always say to women that we always assume that we cannot cheat. We always assume that we cannot fall into this fitna. But it's harder for the men to stay away from this fitna because of just how the society is. It's a lot easier for men to cheat than it is for women to cheat. No matter how much anybody wants to say otherwise, it's a lot easier for the men in the society that way. And I'm not saying generally, anybody that has a mind to cheat can cheat. No, there's no monopoly of it, but it's a lot easier for the men. And it's a lot more difficult for them as well to stay away from it because it's all up in their faces. So I would say that if it's a one-off, if you feel like, look, this man has never shown any sign of this, then it's something that you can actually forgive and help him deal with. But if it's something that he's unapologetic about, or it's a repeated pattern, or it's something that he just doesn't want to talk about, so you know that there's no practical way to make sure that it never happens again, then I will say that you have a very difficult decision to make. Like, is this something that you can put up with long-term? Because it's one thing for someone to do something and be apologetic, but it's also another thing for them to do something, be apologetic, and be willing to take the necessary steps to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Is he going to go to therapy? Is he going to speak to someone? Is he going to be more transparent? Like, is he going, you know, a lot of steps have to be made to try and, you know, make things better. And then trust is something that is so difficult to get back once it's broken. So you have to work on yourself. You have to remind yourself that this has nothing to do with you. A man will cheat because a man wants to cheat. It's not because you're not a good wife or you're not a good partner or whatever it is. It has nothing to do with you, because these things also affect the self-esteem of those who partners to the people that have cheated. It's not just a one-dimensional thing. It's something that affects a lot of people. So you have to work on yourself. You have to make sure that it has ended with solid evidence. Show me that you've cut things off with this person and things like that. And then work on yourself. Work on your self-esteem. You have to have a lot of conversations if you are that kind of couple that have conversations. If not, ensure that he's talking to someone that can help him, you know, get past the temptation and things like that. But it's a very proactive thing, and sometimes it's a very journal phase. It's something that takes a lot of time and healing, and it can either make or break a couple. There are people that have come back from cheating incidents even stronger because the man grows to appreciate what he has, you know, and there's some people that just cannot get past it. And I pray that, you know, whatever the situation is, Allah helps you heal through it. The next question is, what du'as to make during pregnancy? Ah, these ones, they're plenty. I can't even remember. My last pregnancy was almost 13 years ago. My daughter is going to be 12. So, okay, well, maybe 12 to 13 years ago. So I really can't remember the du'as that I used to make. But I know I used to do a lot of rabbanas. So Rabbi Jani, Mokim, Musalati, Wamin, Riyati, Rabbana, Watakabal, Du'a, Rabbana, Ablan, Amin, Azuwat, Chino, Wad, Riyati, Nakarata, Yuni, Wajalina, Lil, Motekina, Imama, Uyidu, Bikalimati, Lai, Minkuli, Shaitanin, Lama, Waminkuni, Shaitanin, Wahama, Waminkuni, Ainin, Lama. All those du'a, Thumma Sabila Yasara'u, for ease in pregnancy. And because I've always been able to word my du'a, a lot of my du'as were very conversational with Allah. Like, I would literally sit for hours. I'm not joking. I just said, Allah, ya Allah, please make this child this, and make this child that, and make this child this. So even now, there's some things that I prayed for over my children when I was pregnant, that when I see that it's not manifesting in them, I tell them, like, I've been praying for this thing since you were in my womb. I know that Allah has heard, you know. It's just for you people to play your part and for us to play our part so that Allah can put barak and the dua can come to pass. So just dua doesn't have to just be Arabic. You can pray in your own, you know, language. You can talk to Allah. You can tell Allah what you want. And in my dua book, the link is in the Pearl Muslima Network page. You can, there's a dua for pious children. And if you just do a Google search, like, you'll get a myriad of dua that you can make in pregnancy. The next question is, how to build your family on the path of Islam? This one, I always say that the only way that you can build a Muslim home, the only way that you can build a Muslim home, first of all, is understand where building a Muslim home comes from. It comes from Allah. So the first step is always to pray to Allah and tell him what you want. Make the niyyah of having a home that will be a place of worship to him, a family that will worship him, a home that will glorify him, a home that will that would have halal and known as a minimal haram as possible and things like that. So make the niyyah to Allah first, make dua to him to make it easy for you. And the onus lies on the partners, the man and the woman in the marriage. The man is supposed to be the imam of the family. So he has to know what it takes to lead a family on the path of Allah. You have to know how to, you know, coerce in a kind way. You have to learn how to teach. You have to learn how to correct in a kind way. The woman is the one that the children would have. I mean, yes, nowadays, you know, sometimes kids have equal access to both parents, but for some reason, children would always naturally gravitate towards their moms. So the woman is the one that would have the most interaction with the children, and she has to learn role modelism. You know, you have to be able to drop everything for Salah, for example. You have to teach your children their dua from when they're teeny tots, like you're going to the bathroom and you're saying out the dua so that they can learn. You know, you have to really, really, really role model Islam. You have to cut out certain things. Like, my kids are at the age now that they like music. I'm constantly yelling, this is a Muslim home, turn off that music, it's haram, this is a house of Quran, turn off that music, and things like that. You have to constantly and deliberately look through the practices in your home. How do we talk to each other? How do we relate with each other? How do we correct our children? What are our practices? What do we do for Eid? What do we do for Ramadan? All these things are what come together to build a Muslim home. You have to constantly reevaluate, you know, your family system and make sure that it's as halal as possible. So these are the ways that you build a Muslim home. But you cannot raise Muslim children, you cannot build a Muslim home if you don't know Islam. So it's also a constant journey of learning for every phase, for every stage. When it's just you and your spouse, you learn how to be a Muslim couple. When you start having children, how to be a Muslim parents, how to be a Muslim family. You know, you have to constantly learn. And as you learn, you teach your children, you implement, and that's how you build a Muslim home. It's work in progress. It's not a one-off thing. Next question is, how to work through polygyny when the other party isn't even trying or likes to act like you don't exist regardless of all you do? It's really, really painful. Like, I was just in my, my staff and I had a free moment yesterday. I was just teaching them about polygyny. And for me, this is one of the most difficult parts, because I was saying to them, I remember saying that, you know, I've been blessed with having a great husband and an amazing co-wife, and polygyny is still a hard pill to swallow. And I cannot even fathom what people that have to do it without either of these go through. It is an emotionally tumultuous journey, but when you have support, it's a lot easier. And a lot of times you don't even remember that your life is any different from anybody else's. But when you don't have the support that you need, it becomes, you know, a bigger trial. It becomes, you know, something that just seems so unfair and so, in fact, it's just so painful. And when you think about the fact that it's the man that kind of brings this thing your way, and then some men get into it, they marry somebody else and they discard the first wife, and not just the first wife, the first family, they treat them like they don't exist. Even their siblings, the in-laws too, will treat the first wife like she's some sort of pariah. And I always say that this is not Islam. The main goal, the main aim of polygyny is family building, is expansion of family in a halal manner. So if you're destroying one family to build another one, you've lost the plot. You have to understand that polygyny is about family building. And I wish that a lot of men will realize this. You cannot jump, you can't be jumping ship. You cannot say, oh, this is the current flavor. Because no matter how much you love your new wife, she will become an old wife eventually. So are you going to jump ship when someone else comes? Or are you going to jump ship and get bored of her and bring in someone else? How fleeting, how, you know, silly can some men be? So what I say to women in these kinds of situations are, look, you have a choice. You have a choice in that situation. If you feel like, look, there's nothing I can do, he's not going to change, this is how he has been for the past 10 years since he married someone else, you have a difficult decision to make. Is this something you want to live with for the rest of your life? Or do you want to give yourself other options, like, you know, just doing life by yourself? Because what's the point in being in a marriage that is emotionally wrecking you? Marriage is supposed to be, the purpose of marriage in Islam are love, peace, tranquility, and mercy. So if you're not getting that from your marriage, and I feel like the purpose has been defeated, so it's something that is worth having conversations around. Talk to your family members, talk to his family members, let them call him to order if they can't. If they cannot, the onus is on you to do what is best for yourself. So you have to work on your self-esteem. Because again, this thing, no matter how strong we are, these things break down people's self-esteem. You feel like, is it me that somebody has discarded like this? You begin to remember all the times you've spent together and whatnot, and you begin to question a lot of things about yourself. You can begin to have serious feelings of envy and even hatred in many cases towards the other woman, even the man, you know. And this is where a lot of women begin to do things that they really shouldn't do. So I always say that if you're in a polygynous marriage and the purpose of that marriage has been defeated, like, and this is something that I say boldly, and this is something that I say even to my husband, that if it ever gets to a point where I don't recognize you, I don't recognize our marriage, then I'm going to leave, because there's no point to it anymore. The whole point of being together is for us to be comfort for each other, peace, you know, show love and mercy. But if it gets to a point, if you ever change towards me, then I'm going to leave. And I understand that not everybody has that choice. Not everybody has, you know, everything that they need to say they're going to leave a marriage. I have a solid support system. I am, you know, independent in my own right. So the thought of being by myself, even though it's very, very, very scary, doesn't scare me as much as it does many women. And I've also never held anything in absolute terms. As much as I love my husband and I love being married to him, even in a polygyny, life can happen. Anything can happen. You know, we might have been destined to spend only X amount of years together. There's no, I don't believe in everything has to be long term. Everything has to be forever and ever. Allah has his plans for us. You don't know what his plans are. So sometimes, you know, we have all the signs pointing at us to leave a marriage, but it's so difficult living our comfort zones. So this is not me saying leave a marriage just because your husband is acting out. Some of them do so temporarily. I've heard many cases of men who, when they marry a second wife for a period, their brains are like fried and they just forget about the first family and they come back to their senses when the novelty wears off. That in itself is something that is painful and you have to deal with. But if it's not long term, you have to start asking yourself certain questions. Is this really good for my peace of mind? Is this really giving me love, peace, and mercy? If it's not, then you have to make some tough decisions as to what is best for your future whilst working on yourself, so that you don't take confidence and self-esteem issues into another relationship if you get into one, if you do decide to leave. The next question is, how do you handle the anxiety that comes with having a sick parent, please? Ugh. This just took me down. You know, this is something that I feel people need to talk about more. Like, it is a grueling experience. And because I've gone through it, I can speak on this. It's a grueling experience. And even when your parents are not sick, like my mom now, I literally have anxiety attacks just thinking about, oh my God, my mom is, you know, going to be 73, like Allah can take her, and it gives me anxiety. Not to talk of the fact that I literally watched my dad die. And it's a really, really, really scary thing. But ultimately, we have to take our succor from Allah. We have to appreciate the years that we've had with them. We have to, in the time that they have left, remind them and, you know, remind them often, be there for them as much as we can, love on them as much as we can, take care of them as best as we can, because the tables turn when our parents become old and frail, especially when they're sick. The tables turn. We become the nurturers. They used to nurture us as babies, you know, and that's why that dua, Rabbi Ram Umar Kama Rabbi Anis Sagira, is so powerful. My Lord, have mercy upon them as they had mercy upon me when I was a child. It's your turn to pay back, literally, when your parents are sick. You have to take care of them, be there for them as much as possible. Ease the anxieties, because there's anxiety of death as well. Remind them a lot about Allah and the afterlife. You know, help them to put their affairs in order. I think that when we take charge of the situation, it's less scary. Like my dad, when my dad was passing, there were so many blessings around his passing. Like even when my dad was literally unconscious, when the Quran was playing, his lips would move along. Like, there were so many beautiful moments that gave us so much succor and just made me feel as if, man, Allah really loves this man. And sickness for a believer is kafara. We have to hold on to that. You know, and that's something that my dad used to say. He'd be like, Samia, I'm hurting, but I want to believe. I believe that this is kafara for me. Allah is expiating my sins. And sometimes I remember one day that I was joking. I was like, man, I must have a lot of leftover sins that Allah wants to expiate. So you need to see things from a Muslim perspective. If you're Muslim, you need to look at things from the perspective of sickness and death. From how Allah has intended them to be. And that's where you draw your succor from. And obviously, when they pass on, if they do pass on from the illness, you have the reassurance of Allah that you will see them again, inshallah, if you play your cards right. If you know that your father was a believer, your mother was a believer, and they did their best. Allah is Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. He's a Lord of mercy. And if you play your part right and you do the right things and you live as a Muslim, you will see them again, to never ever be separated again. For me, I look forward to running into my daddy's arms in Jannah, inshallah. You know, and it gives me so much succor to see him. And when I dream about him now, I see him, he's healthy, he's on holiday, he's having a blast. Those are the dreams that I have. I don't know if it's a figment of, you know, what I pray for him or what I wish for him, but these are the ways that I dealt with it. Just knowing that, you know, he's being healed, he's being expiated of his sins, you know, the healing might not be physical, but it's a spiritual kind of healing, and that death is something that will come for all of us. The way that you die is very important. So it's very important when our loved ones are, you know, sick, that we surround them and we remind them constantly of Allah. Play Quran for them, read Quran with them, you know, just remind them of Allah so that they're in that state, so that they die in a good state. I think that that's the best that you can do. Death will come, either through sickness or whatever means, it will come. And the thought of losing our parents is scary, but it's something that we have to wrap our heads around, especially when they reach certain ages. The next question is, 13 years of fusion and almost 10 years of gift source, how do you stay consistent? I will say that for me, first step is I only do things that I enjoy. So I thoroughly enjoy the things that I do. Gift source, pop, Salam Gift School, fusion, my podcast, my books. I thoroughly enjoy everything that I do. So I have a lot of fun with it, and I delegate. When I started, I had a huge problem with delegation. But since I got the delegation bug, my life has been so much easier. I remember on Sunday, I got fusion at, I think, 12:30. Like, I sauntered in. Everything was already set up. You know, so I delegate. I make sure that I don't stress myself, so it leaves the parts of the business that I really enjoy to me. I enjoy what I do, and I show up every day. Like this past fusion, when I was doing the post event chats with the vendors, a lot of them complained of, you know, lower sales than they're used to at fusion. And you know, you have to remind yourself that some days you have good days, some days you won't have such great days. You just keep showing up regardless. There are times that, you know, you would have issues in your businesses, issues with staff, whatever it is, just show up every day and put your best foot forward. It's just consistency is showing up every day. It's not one big thing. It's showing up every day for the past 13 years for fusion, showing up every day for the past 10 years for GiftSource, growing the business, you know, staying constantly evolving, moving with times, having adaptable focus. These are the things that help you grow your business long term. The next question is, how do I build a relationship with God? And I always say, the same way that you build a relationship with a human being, and you know, God is far, far, far above any human being. But I'm just saying, in practical terms, when you meet somebody that you like, what's the first thing that you do? You get to know the person. So to build a relationship with God, the first thing you have to do is get to know God. And in Islam, it's pretty easy for us. You read his books, and it's so interesting that a lot of people don't stop and think about the fact that the Quran is actually Allah's words. It's not something that Rasul put down by himself. The Rasul was illiterate. He was unlettered. He could neither read nor write. These were words that were brought down via, you know, the best of the best angels, Jibreel, to the best of the best of mankind, as in, and compiled into a Quran that has remained unchanged for all these years. So these are the words of God. So get to know him through his words, get to know him through his names and his attributes, begin to look for signs of him in your life and around you. And that's how you begin to develop your relationship with God. The more you know him, the more you want to know of him, the more you can surrender to him, the more you can live with him. So that's how you develop a relationship. But first, by getting to know him, and then practicalizing the things that you know about him and the things that he likes, things he doesn't like, bringing those things into your life. I think that this is the last one that I would answer for today, and it's because it keys into the previous question. It says, I love how you treat your staff. How do you get good ones and train them? My staff, for me, domestic and business staff, I see them as an amana. An amana in Islam is a trust. So when people come to work for me, I see God has brought person into my life for me to make their lives better in one way or the other. And when you treat people that way, when you realize that they have rights upon you, just like you have rights upon them, your shoulders drop. You realize that this person, if this person gives account of you as a bad boss in front of Allah, you have more to lose than if you say this person was not a good staff to me. And you also do not want someone to raise their hands up and pray against you as an oppressor. So these are all the things that shape how I treat my staff. I'm just like, this is someone's family member. This is someone that somebody loves somewhere that has come, especially domestic staff that has come to work with my family. I have to treat them well. I have to treat them well, because I will give accounts before God as to how I treat these people. And for me, I just believe that for anybody that comes into my life, they must leave me better. Even if it's just from knowledge, skills, from self-esteem or self-worth, you have to leave me better. It's just what I have promised myself. So these are the things that come into play when I'm treating my staff. Like, are they comfortable? Am I giving them the best tools to be the best versions of themselves? Am I simplifying their tasks for them? Am I really paying them what they deserve? Am I helping them become better? Self-esteem, knowledge, how am I helping them better? If they leave me today, what have they gained from working with me? These are the things that influence how I treat my staff. And again, I'm very, very, very scared of somebody telling God that I did not treat them well. So I treat my staff. I try to treat my staff really well. As to where I get them, different places, domestic staff. I have my mother-in-law's housekeeper typically just brings people for me. Work staff, here, there, anywhere, really mishmash, but I believe in diamonds in the rough. So if you come to me and you have potential, I'm more than able to train you into what I want, because my business is not the kind of business that I can say, okay, go to computer school and go and learn skills. No, I have to be able to train. So I'm able to train. As long as you have basic, some basic things, I'm able to train you into what I want you to be. And last question I'm going to answer today is family life. You seem to do a lot together as a family. How did you achieve that? I think that, again, it boils down to what is important to you. And for me, family has always been important. So growing up, I didn't grow up in the kind of family that we used to do a lot together. We used to have dinners or a lot of guests. So from a young age, I knew that when I had my family, I wanted sit-down dinners. I wanted my kids to be my friends. I wanted to have a house filled with laughter, with a lot of kids. And I wanted to host dinner parties and things like that. And I built that life for myself. Thankfully, I have a husband who goes along with my ideas and who loves my plans for our family as well. And we try to enjoy each other's company. It's not like we do things together like all the time. There are days I don't even want to remember that I'm a mother. There are days that I lock myself in my room and I tell my children, just pretend I don't exist today, you know. But I do like to do stuff with my family. I love experiences. I love to think up new experiences for us. I love the look on their faces when they experience things that fit together. I love how they look forward to, you know, our celebrations, because they want, you know, okay, what's she going to come up with? What's she going to cook? What games are we going to play? I love, you know, that they're excited about certain things. I love that my children, now that they're getting older, are more aware of the intention and the love that goes into planning those things, because they see how different our family is from, you know, some other families. And they're like, oh, wow, people, not everybody does this. Not everybody does that. So they appreciate the effort a lot more. And I hope that I'm also sowing the seeds for them to do the same things with their families. And actually, now that, you know, my husband has a second home, it's very important that the time that we do get to spend together is used well. So we try to do as much as we can as a couple with the kids. I just really, really enjoy being with my family and planning stuff and doing stuff. I'm the family planner. My husband calls me the logistics officer. So I plan everything and he funds, and the children are the very eager participants. So yeah, we just have a system that works for us. And alhamdulillah that we've been blessed with the means to be able to, you know, have all these nice experiences. Just the other day on the dinner table, my kids were rehashing some memories, and it just gave me the best, you know, feeling all over my body. You know, they're talking about all a lot of things that we've done together, from holidays to our Eid celebrations to the Eid parties they used to have as kids and things like that. And it just made me so happy that, you know, they had those wonderful memories. And time is so fleeting. Like, I slept, I woke up, and I have a 13-year-old son. Time is so fleeting. And when you think about the fact that that's how it's going to keep going, I'm going to wake up one day, I'm going to be like, can you imagine? I have children that are getting married, inshallah. You know, time is so fleeting. You want to maximize it, because even as the quality of time decreases, the quality decreases, the quantity decreases as well. I'm 41 now, and I know that my energy levels now, as compared with 5 years ago, are not even comparable. So now it takes even more energy for me to get up and say, you know what, I want to plan a dinner party, or you know what, I want to have people over, or I want to do this with the kids. So you have to be really, really intentional. You have to, you know, push yourself. It's not easy. There are days that you rather just sleep in bed, but, you know, the kids want to do something. You have to drag yourself, and because the memories will be so worth it. The memories will be so, so worth it. For me, and again, family life, I find, is a form of ibadah, you know. It's in spending time with your kids that you're able to pass on valuable things. Kids learn more from what you do than what you say. So the way that my children see that my husband and I interact, the way that we treat each other with respect, with love, with kindness, the way that we are as a couple, greatly influences them as well. And these are things that we hope they take into their own, you know, homes and even become better. And it's from interacting with your kids and spending time with your kids that, you know, you hear just about somebody in class and you're able to quickly, you know, pass on a teachable life moment or things like that. So for me, I find that it's not about telling them this. You can sit down with your children 100 times a day and tell them, don't do this, don't do that. But when you are able to practicalize it for them, when you're able to role model it, then it's easier for them to grasp. And for me, it's very important that we have a Muslim home. And because being Muslim in this day and age seems like you have to give up a lot of things, I have to make up for a lot of things for my children as well. So you don't do this, we can't do that. You don't do this, we can't do that instead. So they don't feel like they're missing out on anything. My children, I've never, you know, I hear parents that say, oh, their children ask, why can't we do Halloween or why can't we have a Christmas tree? My children, I've never brought that up because they have their Eid and we go all out with Eid. We celebrate Eid. They get their presents, all the things that they might look forward to at Christmas, we do for them at the Eid. So they don't feel like they're missing out on anything. So for me, it's just very imperative to have a Muslim home. And having a Muslim home requires a lot of being deliberate and intentional. And you cannot teach children if you're far away from them. So we have to spend time as a family for us to be able to teach them the way that we want. So this is the end of this first Q&A session. I would continue next week Wednesday because it's already over 45 minutes long. And I didn't want it to even be this long. But yeah, I hope that I've touched on important topics. There's still a lot more questions and they're more coming in as I record. So we will delve into those ones next week. And let me know what you think. Bye, guys.